Johnny Five is alive, tornadoes toss cows into the sky, and Marvel Comics erupt into a civil war this week on 30-2010.
30-2010, here we go again. Analyzing decades, sitting with our friends, those with different days. And there's so much to say.
Welcome to a new episode of 30-2010, our weekly look back at what happened in movies, music, TV, and games 30 years ago, 20 years ago, and 10 years ago. That's 86, 96, and 2006. I'm one of your hosts, Brett Elston.
Christopher Antista.
Henry Gilbert.
Anna Goodman.
And as we always do, we begin in the 80s. But first, let's give a quick shout out to the Patreon, because this show is brought to you by you.
Yeah.
You helped us unlock this show via your efforts on patreon.com/lasertime. So
this was a tier that people unlocked, so we had to do it, and now it happens. So
I was locked in, and it was scary, and there it's fighting with wolves and things.
Yeah, if you like us, if you like the Laser Time Network, you like what we do, it's obviously would help support us. You get a free weekly bonus show, uncensored and commercial free, and a bunch of other stuff like movie commentaries, the first season of Talking Simpsons, cartoon commentaries, wrestling commentaries. Beautiful.
There's a huge backlog of stuff you'd already get, and then more new stuff all the time. And yeah, again, yes. This is our full-time job, folks, so...
But yeah, we'll begin in 1986, as we always do. We generally tend to touch on a bit of news. In this case, Tenzing Norgay dies at age 71.
Yes. What now? I threw this in here because we're going to represent the brown people in this post-colonial life we have. So back in 1953, with the first people to scale Everest, the highest place on Earth. Mm-hmm. And everyone went shitty and went crazy about how Edmund Hillary conquered Everest. Edmund Hillary, I think he's a Kiwi, he's the best, he conquered Everest. And they ignored the brown guy who led him up there, Tenzing Norgay.
The Sherpa guy?
The Sherpa guy.
He's neither straight nor gay? I had to put it in there. I'm sorry. I apologize.
Tenzing Norgay.
He has the strength of Tenzing men.
He's from the country of Norgay.
So that reminds me of a Simpsons thing. I want every news thing to be a Simpsons thing. Hank. On the Simpsons, where Homer went up the mountain, there were the Sherpas leading him, and I think it had just become a stereotype of, we only count white people that scale things.
Yeah. He got up there too. They're doing it, with no oxygen, 50s level stuff, so they got canvas tents and wool clothes and leather boots. They don't have any fancy plastic Gore-Tex whatever stuff. And they come down and they're like, Edmund Hillary, you're the best. And he's like, yes, I did it myself.
I did it all
myself.
It's like
you had like 400 dudes help you for most of it, and then Tenzing Norgay got you to the top.
Yet another footnote in Western, air quotes, discovery.
We did it.
We did it.
No one had seen this mountain before.
Yes, but we had books. So we did it.
Also news, equally important as this news, is Tommy Lee and Heather Locklear getting married.
Oh, boy.
Tommy Lee, who was the drummer for Motley Crue, he's famous for marrying famous blondes and as well, and for having a huge Schwanstucka. but yeah, he is just...
Happy birthday, Cloris Leachman, by the way.
She turned 90 years old. Yeah. I loved her tweet. Like, I'm 90 fucking years old? How did this happen? But anyway, yeah, the Tommy Lee and Heather Locklear, like, this is kind of a forgotten marriage for both of them, because they both had more
famous marriages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that... Like, Tommy Lee would go on to marry Pamela Anderson and have a sex tape. Heather Locklear would marry Richie Sambuca of the...
Sambuca.
They both traded up, in my opinion.
Who cares?
Yeah.
I just remember I found out she was married to him as a kid because... Well, not as a kid, but it was a... Triumph the Insult Comic Dog was interviewing her and because she was there with her husband at a Bon Jovi concert. And he says... How does Richie's genitals compare to Tommy Lee's? And she said, "Well, every musician I've been with has had a giant penis, so I guess I'm just used to it." But
can I get some definition on giant? Just so I
think he's got like a 12-incher.
Oh, jeez.
You guys, it's really not hard to find.
Am I the only one who watched? Yeah,
dude,
Chris
I've quoted the video before. This is insanity.
Show me your weenus, you know, from I don't, Mr. Show I as a reference to the tape.
I wouldn't know any better, but I would assume 12 is getting to be like... Come on.
Yeah, exactly.
Come
there's,
on.
There's a point where it's like, it's not like even
surgery.
Fun anymore. No.
You'd get used to it, I think.
I could get used to anything.
Can you tell who's the size queen here?
Jesus. Movies, fuck this. Dangerously Close, which is a revenge 80s violence movie.
Reagan era,
like it's, kill the poor people, I guess.
Yeah. Kill the undesirables in
gotta,
the school.
Got a trailer here.
At Vista High. In the name of justice, some students are getting away with murder.
Awesome.
Oh,
yeah.
So can I guess it's white people killing non-white people also?
I think it is. And like the description in the Wikipedia called it jingoistic. And I once and it had an even a blue link. And I realized I still don't know what that word means. And I left anyway.
They're what you collect in Banjo-Kazooie.
Yes.
That's also shocking because next week's episode is going to have a TV movie that now I am convinced was only produced because it ripped off this story, but for a TV movie.
But it's a Canon Films joint, obviously.
Oh,
it's,
yeah.
It's like, it's what do you call it? A Bronson movie in a high school, essentially.
So here's the title.
Dangerously Close.
Just wanted to hear him say it.
Is that...
LaFontaine,
I mean,
probably.
Is it literally Charles Bronson in it?
No, I don't think it's a high school set movie.
I see. Man, that Canon Films documentary, I just watched it again this weekend. I'm like, I could watch this on a loop. I love this film so much.
I can't wait for more of their films in this portion of the show.
But more importantly this week, a lot to talk about here, I think, for us, is Short Circuit.
Yes.
Came out this week 30 years ago.
Short Circuit, which I rewatched in honor of this just to check back in because...
Attractive!
Ooh, do we have a Johnny Five soundboard?
We do have a Johnny Five soundboard, but we also have a trailer.
But it could decide to blow away anything that moves, couldn't it? Because $11 million worth of robot just hit the road.
Wow!
Number Five is alive.
Welcome to my planet.
You just have to find Number Five, get some answers.
Why don't you come on in my house?
Yeah.
So, like, it was bizarre. What's up, Dee?
The music, I think, is the music from North by Northwest.
Really?
Or it's really fucking close.
There's
shit.
Thank you, Johnny Five.
Yeah, like, Short Circuit and trying to find research for this and scrolling around the internet, it confirmed what we already know. No one likes this movie.
Oh, shit.
Nobody likes this movie.
So I saw this... like probably like 87 or 88 as one of those, like, you're in first, second grade, everyone gets to go to the video store for a sleepover and pick out one movie. And then this was one of the first movies I ever saw spending a night at a friend's house.
The VHS box is so inviting to
it. It looks Christ-like.
Like, yeah. But then we watched it and we were all like, this movie is awesome. And then...
this puppet's so cool.
Yeah, the creation of this robot that exists on its own and has these tank treads, but also has these very emotive eyes. It's like Wally straight up looks at this, at Johnny Five.
If you look at Wally, he looks like E.T. and Johnny Five.
Yep.
But he also is something a kid could love because he is a newborn and learning stuff. Yeah. And so he as a naivete, a child can get in.
The premise is the military builds five or six killer robots that would replace soldiers in the field, and one of them gets struck by lightning and they become sentient.
It's a fascinating conceit because the scriptwriters, who also wrote, that'd be S.S. Wilson and Brent Maddock, they also wrote On the Bad Side, Wild Wild West, and Ghost Dad.
Whoa!
But also on the bright side, Tremors and Batteries Not Included.
Wow.
Which is weird to think that two guys are responsible for all this stuff.
Wow, those are all notable.
Yeah, they had a billion different ways they wanted to bring Johnny Five to life and sentience, but the lightning was literally the fastest.
Yeah.
And that's what they chose.
And it's like, look, I'm not going to believe this anyway you spin it, so just have lightning strike the robot.
But it is believable, and, like, you know, Johnny Five was supposed to be stop motion initially, and they built the giant robot. He's the biggest part of the budget. And the reason why this movie sucks is because it's not really that much about Johnny Five. He's a bit player in a movie about Ali Sheedy and Steve Guttenberg.
Well, I mean, they're the stars, not a puppet. Like, I could see Goots or
Ali
Sheedy.
Steve Guttenberg a star?
Stuff like, and what's weird, that clip featured Steve Guttenberg and a man, I had no idea his name was George Bailey. But George Bailey
You're
is...
You're going to help George Bailey.
This is 1986. We just discussed Police Academy. This is Lieutenant Harris... and whoever the fuck Steve Guttenberg's character is. The main bad guy in the Police Academy film is the main bad guy in Short Circuit 2. Or Short Circuit
Attractive.
As well. Playing the same roles from Police Academy in the same year. Like, this
Laser lips!
Fucking love this. How's a kid not supposed to love this?
So the reason I like 1 more than 2, though, maybe I'll change my mind when I rewatch 1. But one feels more like a real production.
Yes.
Like in the 80s, in 86, few people were bigger stars, at least in a comedy,
sure,
than Steve Guttenberg and Ally Sheedy. Like, they were both big deals. And so, but the meanwhile, the second one is like, well, we could afford a robot. We couldn't afford Steve Guttenberg. We could afford Ally Sheedy saying one line.
Yeah.
Over like audio, but not even there. But that's it. Like, and so
but
it feels
they get afford
so
Fisher Stevens. And,
what most people say they hate about
and the brown makeup.
What most people say they hate. I have a ton on that.
Okay.
What most people say they hate about the film, like who made the film, was that the script called for a very different non Steve Guttenberg character, and the movie essentially warped into a Steve Guttenberg movie about a charming white stem cell of a man who's trying to pursue his own creation, where it, you know, was supposed to be like this super deep robotics expert who had to learn how to love and live. Through
that
the robot that became more sentient than him.
That
then Fisher
better.
Stevens, a so lot, lot of great
Fisher
lines
Stevens.
In this movie.
Oh my goodness, I am sporting a tremendous Woody right now.
That is definitely from the first film.
and this is
the stain on the film.
I mean, this definitely makes you feel old. Though I gotta say, this is something that I've seen brought up about Apu, and that I feel like weird about it because I grew up with Apu, like, and it's this thing that makes me feel old, like an old racist in a way of just like, well, no, I grew up with this thing. It's not racist. Like, I just like this. But
try again.
and actual people of Indian descent say you've hired a white dude to have a very broad Indian accent to play a 7-Eleven clerk. When you put it like that, like, oh yeah, is kind of racist.
I'm a billion percent with you on this. Yeah. I'm aware of tokenism, and I understand that stereotypes can be hurtful and all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of weird ways to look at this. One of the fascinatingly behind the scenes that Fisher Stevens was hired to play a guy.
Yes.
And then it turned out the director's like, I think he should be Indian. Mm-hmm. And so they fired Fisher Stevens. And hired who? Bronson Pinchot. Bronson Pinchot to be an Indian character, and then fired him again. So what Fisher Stevens did was he went and lived in India for a month and studied yoga and lived with families.
Jesus.
And so like it's I know it's I'm definitely not going to not condemn the part,
sure,
but it's just like this is like there's a great clip I have later of Aziz Ansari because the Master of None this year took on Fisher Stevens in general.
It opened up everyone's eyes to it in the world.
But when you interview him about it, he's like, I didn't really want. I thought it'd be fun to stretch myself and go learn about this culture and go over to India. And this is a quote from him at the Simon Short Circuit too, because he's boosted up to the lead, where they also changed his last name for some reason. But he says, I'm like the UN, Stephen jokes. I played a Mexican photographer, an Israeli soldier, an East Indian scientist. I then turned down a part to play an Afghani in Rambo 3, and right after that I was offered a role as a guy from Uruguay. I'm an actor, I like challenges, but yeah, sometimes it's frustrates me because I only get cast as foreigners.
Weird.
Huh.
And so, that's, I bet his part as an Afghani in Rambo 3 would have just been like grunting, like, grrr.
And I do. There are funny lines in this movie, and he does say, like, I really did try and adopt the right malapropisms I could to embody this character, and I spent a month in India.
I am standing here beside myself.
And I look at a movie like Cloud Atlas, and like, not great, but like in an equal society where there's no oppression and everybody's treated the same. Yeah, why can't somebody play someone of a different race?
Yeah.
Yeah, if you strip all the realities of the world away.
Totally.
But there has to be some fun to be had
there.
In Cloud Atlas, I think that was the world the Wachowskis want to believe in.
Yeah, believe could happen. And I understand being an Indian actor and being like, well, fuck, I don't get this part because Fisher Stevens does.
You had to clip it from Aziz.
So Aziz Ansari did a great episode called Indians on TV where you dress as stuff like Apu, and both of them are like, Fisher Stevens was in brownface, man. And so he has this great bit on Conan where he talks about that episode and also that he called Fisher Stevens. And like they talked about it and he's like, I'm a 20-year-old actor with a huge part.
Yeah.
And like, what was this? I don't know.
Also, it's 1986, the era of like Long Duck Dong and all these other races. Like,
by the way, Oscar winner Fisher Stevens, which we'll get to and vaguely mention in the next episode.
Oh, okay.
But like, so what happens is, Aziz Ansari's talking about it on Conan. It's great. It's a great clip. You should check out the whole thing. But what happens at the end is that Johnny Five, and that's in air quotes because it's Conan O'Brien's staff trying to assemble a Johnny Five, comes out to confront Aziz Ansari.
All right. Oh, Johnny Five, you're looking like you've aged a little bit. You look a little older than you did in that clip.
Well, you look great, Fisher Stevens.
I'm not Fisher Stevens.
Really?
That's awkward.
You look just like him.
No. Fisher Stevens wasn't Indian. He was a white guy in brownface.
So, are you a white guy in brownface?
No, I'm Indian. I'm an Indian person.
How come you don't sound Indian?
Johnny Five, that's really ignorant. You know, that'd be like me saying, oh, you're a robot. How come you don't go beep, boop, 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 do not compute?
Whoa, hey, that is offensive. Oh... Now I see your point.
That's pretty good. And so, like, we
your mama was a snowblower.
It is like I always like to tell people the sensitive, and people are really gung ho about stuff that, like, you're sensitive to this now, but like people weren't that sensitive to it at the time, and to the extent that the Indian audience, when they saw this film. They thought he was a famous Bollywood actor named Javed something, had to issue a statement saying that it was not him. But because Fisher Stevens was so convincing wore the same glasses.
Yeah, as a kid, I thought that.
Yeah, no, I think it's interesting. I feel like this just came up with the Doctor Strange trailer and people saying, like, why did you cast Tilda Swinton in this part? So why are you taking away from an Asian actor? It's like, you have two choices. Either, like, you give it to a white person and have them do the best they can, or you give it to that ethnicity.
Yeah.
And possibly have them be a ridiculous stereotype.
Yeah, not a glamorous role for an Asian person, the Tilda Swinton role.
Now, it would be great if Marvel created a film about an Asian superhero, like, and gave... Like,
hey, Hulk's Asian now.
Yeah, either you just completely change it, or you have a really broad caricature, or you have step and fetch it really broad caricature.
And I think this...
Yeah, you have a white person in blackface, or you have a black person in blackface. They're still wearing blackface. Yeah. That's still offensive.
No, I remember there was, in the mid-90s, around when Bamboozled come out, but there was this interesting re-examination. There was, I forget the sitcom, but it was this re-examination of, like, we need to celebrate the people, the black actors who were in these horrible step and fetch it roles, just because they were doing the best they could in their system. Like, they were lucky to even be in a movie, and they were often put in scenes that could be edited out in segregated states because people in theaters didn't even want to see that.
It's a no-win situation.
I don't mean to treat this subject insensitively. I get the issues behind it, but it's like even the sensitive people can watch Short Circuit too, because I do love this character.
So that's the thing, is like we talked about Short Circuit 1, I agree with Henry, is like that is a better, quote, better movie. Because it feels in that same realm of like, and it is not as good as any of these, but that stuff from the 80s of like Predator, Aliens, like not as good as these things, but like RoboCop, like the idea of like so much cool sci-fi from the 80s that defined a lot of the 90s and games to this very day, like. But Short Circuit 2 is the movie that kid of the day really wanted, which is just go be a cartoon character.
It has
Johnny
the best
Five.
Johnny Five scenes.
Yes, and that's a more fun movie, but it is a cartoon. Mm-hmm. This is trying to actually be a movie.
The funniest quote I saw from Fisher Stevens is that the script was great and the director of Short Circuit 2 was garbage. And I knew it when I should have known it when he pulled up to set on the first day in a Mercedes with a license plate that read Mr. Director.
Oh dear.
The voice of Johnny
on YouTube, like, Short Circuit 2 has overshadowed any fandom for Short Circuit 1. And I
watched it so many
as a kid's
I feel like
movie,
it was just repeated a ton. I know that's the one I've seen more of.
I'm telling you, it doesn't, because there's
why
like
was
there's
it
not a lot of
so much?
There's not a lot of Johnny 5. There's a lot, but I don't want to sell it short, because the puppeteering behind Johnny Five is astounding. It takes like
input.
He's a real robot. It takes three people to operate. There's a scene where he dances to Saturday Night Fever stuff. He recreates John Travolta's dance that looks like, just to this day, no CG. Like, how the fuck did they do that?
Yeah.
And it's directed by John Bonham, also the director of Bird on a Wire, Stakeout, War Games, and a ton of other 80s movies, but also Saturday Night Fever.
Of course.
And if you just go on YouTube and watch these Three Stooges scene, Johnny Five reprograms 1 through 4. To stop hunting him and to become the Three Stooges, and that scene is an astounding feat of puppeteering.
It's really cool.
It feels prolonged now because, like, how the fuck are they doing this?
Yeah.
He's poking two robots in the eyes and ducking a punch at the same time.
Like real things on a set. I think they're even outside. It doesn't even seem like a set. I feel like they're in the grass.
I searched high and low for what I wanted to really find, because how I originally fell in love with the film, I think, was promoting Short Circuit 2, is that Johnny Five was on a Nickelodeon program. Let's just say it was Don't Just Sit There. These are all lost to time and barely exist with any presence on the internet. Uh-huh. But Johnny Five appeared on these Nickelodeon shows to promote the film as himself. And it was like a preteen asking, so Johnny Five, what happened to you? Like, I got struck by lightning and I came to life. Mm-hmm. And I remember telling my parents, there's this fucking robot that came to life and he's in a movie and like, I don't think that's correct, little Chris. And like, you're wrong. Like, I heard him say it. He farts on screen. Like, and in this interview, I can't find it anywhere. But as a kid, like, just seeing a real robot come out to promote his robot film was fucking mind-blowing.
Hi!
It's a fucking shame that Johnny Five completely disappeared. I was reading what happened to it. There's supposedly a remake that's been brewing for almost a decade. The producers didn't like the script for a third film, and like, I guess that's just it was something people didn't love enough to continue moving forward with.
So after the second one, he's gold. He becomes a U.S. citizen. He becomes a U.S. citizen.
He feels alive.
Yeah, there's no alive here. It's
no
just,
disassemble.
It's because this is all the first movie. But
he's learning about death, blah, blah, blah. And this also, sadly, marks the fifth-year anniversary of the final post on Johnny5.com, the leading short-circuit fan site. It has everything, and I'm kind of blown away by how little Johnny 5 merchandise there is.
Yeah, that's nuts.
I still want one of those little robots from the second one.
Yeah, the fact that they had a toy in the movie that the guy was selling.
It was made to be... It was about you making toys. Yeah. That was the plot of two. Why weren't there
also upon
toys?
And how in all this Comic-Con bullshit, has that not been one of the Chase toys? Like, line up and get your fucking Johnny 5.
Johnny 5 exclusive, but it does feel weird. Like, this was a very special movie to me in the 80s, but it is lost. It is, and it's going to get even more lost.
So, after I saw the second one as a kid, I had a dream, and that dream stayed with me forever, that there was a third one. Mm-hmm. I had a dream about a third Short Circuit that was rated R.
Goes to Vegas.
That seems like the logical next step, although that was the Gremlins thing for years. It was like, they're going to go to Vegas. But it was, there's a third Short Circuit movie. It's rated R.
Whoa.
And because you can tell where my mind is mishmashing all this shit together, his pattern, instead of gold in the third one, he is colored like the construction robot that Ripley gets in Aliens.
Mm.
So it's yellow with all the like lights on him and the pattern of black and yellow.
Oh, that would be sweet.
And he's like a hard ass now.
Because the gold's wearing down at the same rate as the American Dream.
Yeah, that's it, man.
All right. I was actually too inspired to write another robot movie after watching it. Because this has to look cool to kids still. Yeah. Like, it's an amazing feat of illusion and a realistic effects. Johnny Five was voiced by his puppeteer, Tim Blaney. And he
Elf.
Well, the director ended up deciding that they wanted the guy who's essentially mo-capping, anti-circusing Johnny Five to end up voicing him. The same way Raphael got his voice, essentially. Tim Blaney, I was looking into him. He's done a lot of puppet work. Worked with the Muppets on the Muppets from Muppets Tonight to the new show, but he's also the voice. And I have a brief clip of it just because I how have we never heard this voice again? He is Frank the Pug in the Men in Black series.
You busy, Frank?
Sorry, Kay. Can't talk right now. My flight's leaving.
Wow! Get your paws off.
Call the pound. We got a stray.
The dog owes my friend money.
Killians and bugs, Frank. What do you know?
I know nothing.
Not a thing.
Okay. Rosenberg wasn't some two-bit Arkillian. He was the guardian of a whole galaxy. They thought he'd be safe here on Earth.
And the bug had other plans.
The galaxy is the best source for subatomic energy in the universe. If the bugs get their slimy claws on it, kiss the Arkillians goodbye.
My heart was warm to learn this and hear Johnny Five in a character that's been embodied a little more recently.
I can't believe how much every time I think about Men in Black, I'm like, I think I love Men in Black.
Dude, exactly.
And then I watch him again and I'm like, second one's bad.
Ooh,
and then
the second one's awful.
Then the third one.
And then the third one, I was like, boo hiss. And then you're watching on a plane, and it's like, I'm actually tearing up? This stupid baseball scene?
I think the third one's pretty good.
And God damn it. But now it's crossing over with 21 Jump Street?
Yeah, that'll be pretty great.
I can't wait for that.
All right, it is still a Marvel
property. Yeah, but we got to move on. No more Short Circuit.
I bet.
A movie called Fire with Fire also came out. It's a dancing movie?
So there's two TV things
I want to
talk about.
Yes, TV, 1986.
All right, so May 10th is the airing of what was to be the series finale of Remington Steel. And the episode is even called Bonds of Steel.
Oh, no!
Is a humorous thing. So
just talked about this on a Laser Time.
In 1986, they were on the verge. The Bond team was on the verge of making the 1987, I believe it's Diamonds Are Forever, the Timothy Dalton.
License to Kill?
No, Living Daylights.
Living Daylights. It was Living Daylights with Timothy Dalton. Mm-hmm. But they wanted Pierce Brosnan. And by having his show Remington Steel canceled, he was free to film the movie. And as he is just getting ready to leave, he finds out that NBC gave the show a reprieve at the last second, like, you know, we do want a fifth season. And, like, he's done. He won't be Bond for 9 years.
It's become the source of urban legend because it's like, it claims that he was signed on to play Bond would Remington Steele not move forward? Mm-hmm. The producers of Remington Steele learning that somebody else wanted Bond, like, well, maybe there's something to this character, yeah. Remington mm-hmm. Steele.
Yeah,
let's renew it. So they make it sound like he was like 2 days away from a press, like a day away or yeah. behind a curtain.
Yeah, I've heard he was literally leaving his house. He yeah. was like getting yeah. his keys
to announce he's Bond,
getting the tuxedo on.
Mm-hmm. So was he just trapped in that that contract?
He's just like, stuck in the contract.
Dude, it took another decade.
Yeah.
Well, so the inside thing in Hollywood is that when you sign on to do a show on the pilot, standard is you sign on for 7 years. You say, like, well, then if you're going to put me on a TV show, I will be in this contract for 7 years. That's usually why in the seventh year you see big name shows like Friends or Seinfeld or
Bang
Modern
Theory
Family or Big Bang Theory all renegotiate to mega deals yeah. to keep them on past seven.
It's one of the reasons Next Gen went off the air.
Mm. And that's also why Community ended at season six. And they're like, no, we really can't do seven because all these people we signed on to their six-season contracts, that's over now.
There's nothing flimsier than a Yahoo contract.
But their original contracts were like, say you'll do Community for 6 years. Now we'd have to pay you more to come back for seven. So anyway, that was the thing there where if the show was canceled, then he was free. But if they went on with season five, he is contractually obligated to be on that season.
I can't imagine what that feels like.
The scheduling on it must be so tough because you got to do like 24 episodes of the show. Yeah. And then Bond movies, you got to film a bunch of different places all over the world. They take a while.
Well, it was going to make him like
a happy ending at least, right?
In the 80s,
you got to be in four great James Bond movies.
GoldenEye fucking rules.
Does it?
I love GoldenEye.
Jordan Baker for life.
But in the 80s, it was also very rare, I think, for a TV star to ascend to movie star. And so you got to think he was also thinking, oh, I'll never be a movie star now.
He must be thinking, this is it. I've aged out of it now.
Yeah, totally. Though so in the episode of Bonds of Steel, Remington Steel, when they thought it was the finale, he like gets married in the end, and it is totally like ties everything in a neat little bow. And so then the season five premiere, and a few months later, they have to like kind of explode that and be like, oh no, you have a reason to keep doing this, Remington Steel.
Renewed it and hit syndication for nothing. Yeah, I've never seen this syndicated anywhere. Mm-hmm. I only know Remington Steele's a footnote to James Bond.
Yeah.
But I think it also took like 9 more years because they couldn't figure out some legal stuff after Living Daylights. Mm. Bond was in limbo for like 5 or 6 years.
No, they had a little bit of legal stuff they had to deal with, and also, you know, they tried to go back to basics with Timothy Dalton so he'd be like edgier and tougher, and you totally see that in License to Kill, his second one, where, you know, he's much more of a bastard in the vein that we kind of see now with Daniel Craig, but he just couldn't quite sell it, and they were just dying, man. Mm-hmm. And they were like, okay, we got legal stuff to do. Albert Broccoli, the main producer, dies in between here and there.
It was
a
United Artists property that went over to MGM.
Right.
It's currently
MGM
separated by Sony.
Right, MGM got bought up by, or UA got bought up by MGM, and there's lots of stuff. And they're like, we don't know how to do this anymore.
Pretty
and
soon.
Finally, they figured out, you know what? Let's just get Pierce Brosnan and have him be really fucking smashing all the time. And that's the fun thing about GoldenEye is that it addresses like, oh, by the way, the Soviet Union ended since we've been here. P.S. We lost our main bad guy.
Yeah. And now you have a nerd with a satellite.
Always a fucking nerd, man. And then on May 12th was the airing of the NBC's 60th anniversary celebration, which, watching it now, it's kind of...
Just of NBC. I felt like you were missing a word.
No, NBC turned
just
60.
NBC.
It had begun in 1926, so we're getting on the 90th anniversary now. And
see why a network would want to celebrate its 90th anniversary publicly on air
And 86 was such a strong year for NBC. Like, The Cosby Show and Cheers, like, were both winning everything. And this is... I watched some clips from it, and it's one of those things just poisoned by... Oh, Cosby's so big, so Cosby's all over this. And the Cosby kids are the main characters on it. They're doing a tour of Rockefeller Center through the plot. Malcolm Jamal Warner and Keisha Knight Pulliam. So the most interesting thing about it is that was where they premiered the new Peacock logo, which has basically stayed the logo to this point. And it ends with a bunch of NBC stars standing around a big version of the logo and
huge.
Then singing a song.
Gross. That's Steve Allen?
Johnny Carson. There is a network.
Carl Reiner. Jesus.
Jesus. Captain America footage.
I mean, can you believe being like, I'm Johnny Carson. Like, you're going to make me a part of a glee club with all these other jerks? Like, come on. Yeah. Wow. But anyway, so.
All right. Oh,
there's some big shoulder pads going on. Jesus. And Jack Klugman.
Most of those people are dead in that picture.
Yeah.
Taking us out of the 80s, music this week. The Cure has Standing on a Beach, which is a singles compilation album. I believe this is right before they really blew up in the U.S. with 87's Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me. Yeah. That has a lot of the Cure songs that I know.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I think West End Girls is number one this
week.
Which I couldn't remember if I've played out the 80s yet with West End Girls.
Yep.
I think I did.
Yeah, you did.
So I was going to do this.
Rules.
Yeah.
You always have El DeBarge's Who's Johnny, if you wanted.
What?
The official Johnny Five theme song, which he stupidly, I just can't get, in the movie dances to his own theme song before he like even knows his own name.
That's
Let's
cool.
do that. What's that song called, Chris?
Who's Johnny?
All right. That's the song you're going to hear. And when we come back, what happened this same week in 1996?
On Cape Crisis.
Left, directing Flash left over saying left. Creative differences.
Yeah.
I didn't like the Vision.
Which,
Paul Bettany, not my guy. No,
though it also was his first time directing, so it could Warner could have said, our creative direction is we don't want to give $200 million to a guy who hasn't directed a movie before. Could also be that.
I think Marvel's good at that, but the Fantastic Four has made everybody a little weary of first-time-out visionaries.
That guy ruined it for everybody, man.
It could have been ruined for him. I don't know. Josh Trank, hope you get to make another movie.
Yeah, just for like
Not
$5 million. Make your own Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and prove you're ready again. That's Cape Crisis, the comic book podcast you must listen to every Thursday or Friday.
The critics are blown away.
It's coming!
An excellent adventure. Exciting and visually astonishing.
Fight!
Intensely entertaining.
You guys should get out of there! Run! It's gonna drop right on us!
A nerve-tingling combination of terror and wonder.
Find something to grab a hold of!
Twister. Now playing at theaters everywhere.
That's what makes us humans beating. Shine on, shine on. Shine on, shine on.
That is Van Halen, Humans Being, bringing us in to 1996. I love this song so much. This is at a time, we'll get into it, but it debuted with Twister.
I think this is way past its time.
Debuted with Twister and the soundtrack and the movie, but like the shot of the... Fucking love Twister so much, man. It is such a dumb movie that... man, I could go on and on about Twister, but just this song bringing us in, like it hits the... The verses of this song suck. It's like him trying to do a and it doesn't work with Van Halen.
Like rapping.
And this is like the last Sammy Hagar song for Van Halen too. And I had a friend at the time like who was super into Van Halen, and we would go back and forth about I was really into Duran Duran.
Van Hagar.
He was really into Van Halen, and we would just crisscross. We'd put six CDs in a six CD changer and just like fight about the random shuffle of like Van Halen, Van Halen, Duran Duran, Duran Duran. And this is a song when I heard it in Twister, and it's like a big crane shot or like a helicopter shot of all the trucks and vans following the tornado, and the song picks up. I'm like, this is fucking awesome. And this...
I saw that I have a note about that shot. That shot
looks
so awesome. Because they are driving the cars at an extremely slow speed, and a helicopter is screaming in as fast as it can. So it looks like modern CG, even though it's just a simple camera trick.
Nice. Love it. But real quick in music also, new albums from Tori Amos. Boy, this is the 90th shit you're ever going to hear. Mm. New albums from Tori Amos, Rusted Root, K.D. Lang, and Soul Asylum.
I think that's only the Twister soundtrack, right?
Oh, shit. Yeah, that's all the Twister soundtrack. That's what I mean. Yeah, like this is all the Twister soundtrack. Mariah's Always Be My Baby is number one, which is a good song.
Or no, not still. Is that a new one?
That's a new one. I think that's a new number one. Released
I love
that song. I like it too. It's released in 1995's Dreamland. That is her 11th number one song, tying with Madonna and Whitney Houston.
Damn.
She will eventually get more. In Europe, the Backstreet Boys have their album that adds a bunch of songs. I think like Backstreet's. No, I think that's later. The U.S. would get caught up in Backstreet Boys, I think, the next couple of years. But like a lot of the songs that you know from pre I Want It That Way Backstreet Boys are on this album that the US didn't get until like a little later. Butthole Surface Electric Larryland came out, which has Pepper, which is a song I remember seeing on MTV all the time. We might hear it later in the show. And also an album from Pitch Shifter, who I only know for having a song on the Mortal Kombat Annihilation soundtrack.
Of course.
But the big album this week is definitely the Twister soundtrack. And as we get into movies, fucking Twister.
It's crazy just looking at the people involved in the production. Yeah. One, it's Steven Spielberg in a pre-DreamWorks world.
Yep.
Steven Spielberg has an idea he wants to produce with Amblin. So who wants to be involved? Well, I'm Steven Spielberg. I can pretty much boss everybody around, get anybody to do anything. So I'm going to pay Michael Crichton and his wife $2.5 million to write the script.
Yep. Yeah.
Joss Whedon will do
Hot off Jurassic Park.
I will not only partner with Warner Brothers, I'll partner with Universal. I will get I will get Van Halen to write the song. So like the pedigree behind all of this is
pretty
insane.
Nuts.
They were gonna get Helen Hunt and
I've only mentioned that because Helen Hunt had to
Jon DuBont directing, right?
Yes. Mm. Jon DuBont directing and Helen Hunt had to delay going back to Mad About You because of Twister.
This gave me like as a 15-year-old I had a huge crush on her because of this movie.
Oh yeah.
Like, she's cool.
She just seemed like a cool
person.
I really want to hang out with you
I don't want to ruin it. I have a clip of what I consider to be one of the stupidest scenes.
The whole movie is ridiculous.
The whole movie is ridiculous.
Can I get really classic and specific for a second?
Please.
Brett.
Yes.
Did you notice that Twister and His Girl Friday are the same movie?
They have the
exact same plot structure. Twister just took His Girl Friday, and instead of being a news story, it's about scientists. And instead of it being about a convict, it's about Twisters.
Yeah, because she's trying to get out of that life and keeps getting pulled back in. I can't believe I'm relating to this.
There's a fiance that just sort of walks off at the end.
Yeah, wow, holy shit. And instead of a tornado, it's like, it's this story of a guy that's going to get sentenced to death. And
it's a gay musical number.
Wow.
Yeah, mind
I am really surprised by this.
God damn it.
I'm so glad that His Girl Friday is the classic movie that you picked to watch with this coming up.
Man, I'm kind of my mind is kind of blown by this.
You tied barbed wire to Casablanca and now Twist.
But here's the trailer for Twister, really quick.
Elusive, unpredictable, violent. It terrifies most scientists. But for a new breed, the challenge is saving lives. The research is deadly. The laboratory is nature itself.
So bizarre.
So there's a lot that I also got to add to this. So it's 1996, and this movie kicks off a summer that will kind of change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like from this point on, you can argue like, that was a big summer. This was 93 had Jurassic Park, and Jaws kind of maybe started the whole summer tentpole thing.
I mean, this is Jurassic Park.
But 96, this is like a barrage of crazy shit that happens almost weekly that now every year looks back. Well, 97 has to be bigger. 98 has to be bigger. 99 has to be bigger. 2000 has... Like, it starts here.
Yeah, Twister's whole proposition does seem like a little quaint by the standards of modern blockbuster movies.
Sure, like, but this is also the...
Five
like,
tornadoes.
Like, CG has finally caught up to a point where it's like... Yeah, we're still remembering Terminator 2, we're still remembering Jurassic Park, but what we haven't done is the new crazy CG disaster movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what is a disaster that you can borderline personify?
Yeah.
A fucking tornado.
Yeah.
Yep.
And as a Midwesterner who grew up in constant fear of tornadoes, this movie was so fucking big where I was because you could look at this thing that has terrified you as an abstract idea, as a physical manifestation, being worried about funnel clouds going right over your house, seeing tornadoes, the cone touch the ground a mile away, and you're like, are we dead? I don't know. And watching this movie was like this catharsis of like, it's almost a Godzilla moment where like, not equating this to being nuked and finally seeing personification of nuclear terror.
None of us had this perspective. I never thought of it.
In a sense, this, because a hurricane, you can't do that.
Yeah.
Tornado is like, that's an earthquake, you can't do that. It's all disaster point. It's buildings falling. A tornado, it's like
a physical thing, you can point at it, and it's coming this way.
And they do such a good job of making every tornado in this movie seem different to the point of, I would buy a toy of that fucking tornado if you would make one. There's the water one. There's the huge F5.
It's like different gremlins.
Yes, and there's this also
the mud in the truck.
This is also at the same time, 1996, that the Weather Channel is huge. I'm not kidding. The ratings for Weather Channel blow up partly because of this movie.
Well,
disaster coverage, storm coverage.
It's the nature of tornadoes that they're unpredictable, like a Jurassic Park dinosaur.
Yeah, so, but like the Weather Channel's ratings blow the fuck up this year, and it becomes like there are newspaper articles, there's coverage on TV about the Weather Channel because everyone's like, oh yeah, storms are crazy. We should watch that shit, right? And Weather Channel spends the next 5 years trying to be cool and failing miserably.
So I watched this because of the CG thing. Like I became kind of a storm chaser for CG at that point because I was like reading Starlog magazine mainly just to know like, oh, this thing will have the better special effects than the last thing that had great special effects. And could you imagine what special effects they put in Star Wars now? Like special effects, like,
oh, you wait until the next second.
I know. But so I loved all that stuff. And that's why I went to it. Now, I didn't love it as a movie either. I liked it fine. I had a good laugh at the cow, though I also...
Did you know that cow is CG model of the zebra from Jumanji?
Wow. I did not. Oh, and I also remember one of these first times where I became a cynical viewer where...
I'm just going to play this underneath.
The second I heard them say, like, oh, this can... the storm can blow, the wind can blow stuff so fast it goes through a wall. I'm like, well, we're seeing that. It's like, you don't say that without showing.
Yeah, I think my biggest complaint is that there didn't need to be evil scientists.
And, fucking love it's Cary Elwes, though.
I love it's Cary Elwes. Yeah. I love Bill Paxton can actually sell a line like, they don't care about the science, they're in it for the money.
What are you...
What fucking money?
Yeah, tornadoes are your hobby? Well, you like to lose a brand new Dodge Ram every week?
And they've got all the like identical black SUVs in the perfect distance of each other driving along.
That whole summer, we would call them Twister Death Black Vans. Wow. And every time we would see them on the highway or on the street, because we all had driver's licenses not long after this, and it was like, when you saw two or three trucks go by, they're all black, because like, there's a lot of military bases around us, there's a lot of maximum security prisons around us, because there's a lot of flat land that you can build runways and shit on, and we'd be like, hey, there goes the Twister guys. Like, this movie, I've watched this movie so many times, and probably haven't seen it in 15 years.
Yeah, it's the movie I like the least that I've watched the most.
And it was known for being a lot of improv,
the snobs,
right?
Versus slobs.
Well,
stuff
the improv, the cast in general is great. Like, it's
the
fucking
the camaraderie of everyone in this cast is like...
It's the first time I ever saw... I think I saw Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
And that's the best trivia I have from this movie, because it ties into Roger Rabbit. There is a scene in the theatrical version in early VHSs where Philip Seymour Hoffman lifts his legs while laughing and shows his balls. And that has been digitally altered in every subsequent release. Speaking of subsequent releases, this is the first Hollywood mainstream film released on DVD and one of the last released on HDVD.
I actually found a clip. This is when I think of Twister and Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Mm-hmm. The suck zone. It's the point, basically, at which the Twister sucks you up.
And he's telling that
to
the new wife, who's like, well, we're getting married soon. And she's terrified of like, Bill Paxton, will you please just come and get our normal wedding and our normal life? But then...
I'm going to take your tornado. I'm going to hurt her.
So the idea is they're chasing these tornadoes, and there's two groups of scientists. There's the fun, scrappy people that we're supposed to root for, and then the Cary Elwes goons, who both have the same idea of...
This movie's so dumb. Like, deliciously dumb.
There's we got to put this sensor in the path of a tornado, and when it goes up, all these electrodes and shit will fly out and give you a map of the tornado, and all that data then will let us analyze what a tornado is actually happening in the middle. And then the movie climaxes, of course, them tying themselves to a pole, and a tornado runs over them, which they survive. Which,
like, for a dumb action movie, I've never forgotten that sequence.
Yeah,
ever.
And it's like, but I'm like... That's an F5. You've gone to great lengths of describing, because like where I grew up,
it's a John Cena thing now.
Well, an F.
That's a Brock Lesnar thing, but
whatever.
Suck a dick. Diana hates me.
But an F5 hit where I was.
Really?
Like before, I think I might not have been alive yet, but like I might have been really, really young, but it was a mile wide tornado that fucked everything up, like flattened shit. So to see this in a movie was like, oh, that's the thing. And to watch them like kind of survive, it's like that's like 300 miles an hour with shit flying everywhere. A penny would destroy you.
Even if they were like lucky enough to not be struck by any debris, they would be just ripped in half anywhere. Like their arm would be their arms and legs would be broken.
Would you asphyxiate maybe? There's just the pressure.
Yeah, I don't know.
Pressure. That's an excellent. It is the movie that did kind of usher in like every summer blockbuster needs a shitload of CG.
Yeah.
But the practical effects made it one of the most dangerous sets of all time. Because if you remember the movie, like tornadoes come out of nowhere and then the sky gets black and gray.
Black and green.
But
the
rest of the movie,
it's crazy, man.
It's bright blue because they could not find the overcast locations and shoot days that they wanted.
Wow.
So what they did was shine gigantic lights into Helen Hunt and Bill Paxton's eyes, so they could the exposure would make the sky look darker, and they blinded them. They burned their retinas, and they had to have eye rehab. Bill Paxton required a hepatitis shot. Helen Hunt suffered a concussion in the cornfield sequence.
Yeah,
wow,
you have a clip to hear that you say
this is the stupidest thing ever because it's Twister trying to make Helen Hunt her Batman moment of why she's doing this.
What's wrong with you? We can still do this.
Jesus Christ, listen to yourself. You're obsessed.
You've never seen what that thing is.
There's no talk to me about
that. You've never seen it. You've never seen him miss this house and miss that house and come after you.
Christ, Joe, is that what you think it did?
She's basically saying, yes, I now devote my life to studying tornadoes.
I now devote my life to fighting tornadoes.
I will take down the tornado that killed my father.
Yes.
Helen sells it.
And that's right after the line, you gotta look at what's right in front of you. Like, every cornball dialogue, stupid score.
But that's why it's so fun. This is such a
I think it would be really
fun
to revisit.
I love this movie.
Hey, let's get into TV.
TV this week. Oh, never mind. It's in here. Great.
Two little facts I have. Just the original VHS opened with a Bugs Bunny and Tasmanian Devil reanimated short.
Oh, yeah.
Just to define what a fucking tornado is for kids. And that Twister ride it out, a terrible ride at Universal Studios that replaced Ghostbusters, is just now being shut down. Like 20 years later, it's being replaced in Universal Studios, Florida, with Jimmy Fallon's Race Through New York, which he just announced on a show he just shot in Vancouver. I'll leave that at
Jimmy Fallon will never be dated. In TV, I'm going to skip ahead a couple things on the list here, but on May 7th, not to be outdone, Fox airs the TV movie Tornado!
Yay!
Exclamation point. A Twister ripoff starring Bruce freaking Campbell.
Weird.
Yep.
I definitely watch this.
I watched this too.
There is a phenomenon of nature. Dark and mysterious. A force that strikes without warning.
Bruce Campbell's charisma.
So powerful and so devastating.
Yep.
It destroys everything in its path.
Give me some sugar.
I want to hear.
You're not going to hear. He's not. Tornadoes are the selling point. But still,
that looks terrible.
That's it.
Philosopher.
Wow.
Tornado!
It has an exclamation point.
Yeah, that's why I said it. The tornado!
I did watch this because I like Bruce Campbell, and I was so hyped on Twister, I'm like, I'll watch anything.
I watched clips of... this spawned a ton of tornado movie ripoffs because everybody was like, well, we can make a fucking computer-generated tornado. And it was interesting to see what they forgot about is all the stuff that John DeBont, a crazy director who just came off of Speed... is the stuff they did that didn't involve the Twisters at all. The fence posts flying up in the air, the stuff through the cornfield.
Yeah.
None of those movies could reproduce anything but the tornado itself. Well, none of its damage.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's inspiring in a way that they're just like, oh, this giant, expensive CG fest is coming out. We can make it for TV with nothing. Like, we've got wind. I get wind machines and get Bruce Campbell.
It shows you how that was cynical. And like, you were just thinking about the tornadoes.
Get a truck, pick it up on a crane, drop it into shot, Yeah. Oh, no, it dropped that truck.
We didn't mention that there was this proof of concept shot that was then used in the trailer of a tire never hitting a windshield that didn't end up in the movie.
Right.
And
somebody
actually sued Warner Brothers
over
it.
Like,
because this was supposed to be in the theater.
Yeah, the trailers leading up always concluded with this tire bouncing from the background and smashing into your view in the
first
camera.
First person behind a windshield.
Like, you getting hit with debris, and you're just like, smash cut, Twister. And then it's like, the whole movie, we're like, where's that fucking scene, man? And then it didn't happen. It's like,
I was annoyed to see that Bruce Campbell, like, I was trying to find him a scene from him of him in it, but there wasn't one. The closest I could find was him in promotional stuff for Ash vs. Evil Dead, hosting local weather reports, and I was like, I wish I had been there to say, like, well, I'm glad he's here, because this guy knows about tornadoes, right? And see if he even remembered doing this film.
I can't stress how much I watched this movie.
So on May 6th,
love to watch it again.
Speaking of TV movies, on May 6th was the NBC TV movie No One Would Tell, which is a true life story of an abusive boyfriend in high school murdering his girlfriend. It's memorable because it is played by the abusive boyfriend is Fred Savage, and the dead girlfriend is Candace Cameron of Full House fame.
Oh, boy.
Deej.
It's similar to...
Was Full House over yet?
I think it's 97.
Oh, that's right.
And
man,
she's in an NBC TV movie?
Yep, a TV movie about where she is an abused girlfriend. And I think in both these cases, it was them trying to show, like, we have to grow up. We have to teach the public that we're not our kid selves anymore.
Yeah.
And they make films like these for transitional-ish roles like that. I always think back to the Britney Spears movie Crossroads, where it says, in the film, she is literally deflowered and grows up. And so,
not a girl, but... Not yet a woman.
Not yet.
Exactly.
So you have a clip here.
Well, wait. I got to set it up.
All right.
So the other weird thing I found in it from watching, the full movie's on YouTube if you care to watch it. The interesting thing is that Sally Jesse Raphael, talk show host with giant red glasses, plays the judge in it. And not unlike in the MST3K film, I Accuse My Parents, it ends with the judge then looking to camera and telling the audience what they're supposed to feel. So this is Sally Jesse's speech.
Before we leave, there's something else that I wanted to say.
Oh, my God.
How many of you have been hit? Who among you slaps their girlfriend? Well, this is against the law. This is wrong. And you know what? You watched it happen to Stacy, and you did nothing. You have a responsibility to the people that you...
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's corny. Like,
it's just amazing how many men in the audience of this jury are like,
I guess we all slap our girlfriends.
Bill Burr joke in a stand-up about that. Like, so how many domestic abuse purveyors did you reach with that message? Really?
Oh, it is against the law.
Wow.
I love how she said it's against the law, not it's
morally
a bad thing to do, you monster.
Maybe she's being in character as the judge of, like, the judge would talk about the law.
I am above morality. The law.
Just the law. Come on. So, and Fred Savage. Don't worry, guys. Fred Savage does get life in prison at the end of it. So
He pays
for
it. It was at that time in my life I was the happiest I'd ever been.
So Roseanne season 8 finale airs May 7th, which is technically the last real episode of the show. It is the wedding of Darlene and John Galecki, whatever his character's name
that
was.
That guy has to be the richest person in television.
He really does. But so after the wedding, it's an outdoor wedding, and the cliffhanger is... John Goodman's character, Dan, has a heart attack, which I'm shocked has not happened to real John Goodman in the last 20 years.
Do we have that on Laser Time about greatest final episodes?
Yeah, so but this wasn't the final episode.
It was, but it technically,
so season,
chronologically is.
Season 9 begins with them going like, oh, you live through it, and we win the lottery, fun time.
We're going to go on a bunch of trips and do a bunch of extravagant things and meet Ernest on an airplane. That did happen, Elson.
And so it is revealed that on the last episode of the series that the final season was all made up, or was made up by the character Roseanne writing a happier ending for their lives.
Because Dan died of that heart attack.
Because Dan died from that heart attack.
So she created the ideal life. It's revealed that people who are gay or not, and it's really moving.
I thought something was strange when one of the last season episodes is her basically being Rambo.
It's a lot of fantasy sequences. Yeah. So they go to Gilligan's Island and become Yeah. Castaways.
Also on May 11th was the 1996 Kids' Choice Awards on Nickelodeon, hosted by Rosie O'Donnell and Whitney Houston. Queen Latifah got slimed on it. And of the winners...
Can we hold up? Yes. That's one of the weirdest combinations I've ever heard.
Rosie O'Donnell and who?
Whitney Houston.
Holy shit.
I don't know what she was promoting in 96 for kids.
I just imagine the most traumatized assistants of all time.
Oh, Jesus.
Well, they had to go through a lot.
The pain.
But yeah, Queen Latifah, like, she took the slime bullet. And also, the big winners that year were Ace Ventura 2 won Best Movie.
Of course it did. Nickelodeon Kids' Choice Logan. Loves a good jerk off scene.
And okay, so this was 1996.
Look, him coming out of that rhino is still so great.
So this was 1996, but Donkey Kong Country, which came out in November 94, it won Best Game. And two of the games it beat were Tiny Toons Adventures, Buster Bus Loose.
That game is great. Way better in hindsight.
Like, oh, wow.
And X-Men Children of the Atom.
So all of those games are too old to be in this list.
Yes. It's a very, based on what was top blockbuster rentals of 95 or
like, those are all like 94 games.
Yeah, it doesn't.
That's American media data for you, though.
Yeah. It could be very late to them getting that stuff.
Even the video game sales data is still really, really slow compared to other countries.
And lastly, you know, we never talk about Pinky and the Brain on here. But so the May 12th episode, I'm going to count on Diana for this one, too. So the May 12th episode was the episode called The Third Mouse. Now,
Pinky and hello.
So the character The Brain was created because voice actor Maurice LaMarche entertained the writers on Animaniacs with his pitch-perfect Orson Welles impression, which you'll also hear in the film Ed
the
Wood.
Critic. And Ed Wood. He voices over Vincent D'Onofrio as Jesus.
Yeah, he has a perfect Orson Welles. And so The Brain is created of Pinky and the Brain. Well, we're going to do tonight, Pinky. Brain. Try to take over the world.
And take over the world.
And they got their own show.
It's more James Mason.
It's a little James Mason.
And so they made multiple jokes on the show that were just, oh, this is a reenactment of an Orson Welles scene. They had an amazing one where Brain almost word for word reenacted the Orson Welles lost frozen peas.
the blow up over his... That's one of the funniest bootleg things you can find. Orson Welles screaming at the person who wrote his ad copy.
And so in this episode, the third mouse is a black and white full parody of the film The Third Man, which is Orson Welles is actually barely in the film, though his scene is so memorable as Harry Lime on the Ferris wheel.
I mean, they talk about him so much.
It was a tagline of the film, right? Who is Harry Lime?
When he does appear, like, oh shit! Mm-hmm.
Harry Lime's here, and it's the best dude in the world.
He's like, oh my god!
The John Candy movie?
Harry
Crumb.
The Third Man is an amazing film on its own.
Really
it's not
great.
Just Orson Welles that makes it great, though he is the best part of it. So, the most famous scene in it is the Ferris wheel scene, which they do reenact in Pinky and the Brain. And I want you to know how closely and how perfectly they recreated it. So, the first clip I have there is the finale to the Ferris wheel scene, which has one of the best exit lines in film history.
Yeah.
Well, what the fella said, in Italy for 30 years under the Borgias, they had warfare, terror, murder, and bloodshed, but they produced Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and the Renaissance. In Switzerland, they had brotherly love. They had 500 years of democracy and peace, and what did that produce? The cuckoo clock.
Boom! And that's Harry Lime defending his, like, violent criminal life of just, like, that having this kind of chaos breeds beautiful things. Like, and so, meanwhile, on the episode The Third Mouse... has fallen in love, and he has decided that he is going to turn his back on taking over the world and domination and violence in a way. And so here's that version of the scene.
Point. In Italy under the Borgias, they had 30 years of murder, bloodshed, and warfare, and they produced indigestible noodles, boring operas, and the Fiat. In Switzerland, they had brotherly love, 500 years of democracy and peace, and what did they produce? The Swiss bank account, the best cheese in the world, and Heidi.
Grandfather!
All right, that's
it. Just more than ever, it's on, and Animaniacs is on Netflix. Like, I remember reading about how executives were mad at Animaniacs and Warner Brothers cartoons for not making for making too many cartoons that adults liked more than kids.
Yeah.
Listen to this shit.
I feel like I can't believe I've never seen this episode because I feel like I should have gotten the postcard in the mail that said, Diana, we made something only for you.
Well, I never got to see Pinky and the Brain because it moved over to WB, which I didn't have.
And it was also, this was a primetime episode of it. They put it in primetime, I think, because they realized, like, oh, these are all for grown-ups. jumps. Let's see if we can get
the whole
Simpsons
world
audience.
Needs to experience these third man references.
This
is why, like,
do they have a chase through the sewers with like lots of oblique angles?
That is how it ends. Yes, yeah.
It's just another example of like watching so much Simpsons and Tiny Toons and Animaniacs. It's like, that is why we have these weird connections to 60s and 70s shit, is because all those people grew up to write the shows that we watched in the 90s.
We did put up an article on LaserTimePodcast.com that is all the Citizen Kane Simpsons references shown side by side. It's great. Beautiful. Good job, Anki.
Taking us out of television, I was just going to play that the Butthole Surfer song Pepper from Electric Larryland. And when we come back, we will talk about this same week in 2006.
Coming down the mountain. I don't mind the sun sometimes, the images it shows. I can taste you on my lips and smell you in my clothes. Cinnamon and sugary and softly spoken lies. You never know just how to look through other people's eyes.
Mrs. Internet and all the ships at sea. Welcome to Diana's Classic Corner. We talk about movies even further back in the past this week to see if there's something worth watching. And speaking of Orson Welles, you bet your ass there is. May 8th, 1966, Orson Welles' Chimes at Midnight, a.k.a. Falstaff, barely released in the U.S. It has not, I believe, been on U.S. DVD. I think it's been remastered, maybe, and it's been at some art house theaters and stuff. Or you can get an import DVD. I finally saw this one, seriously, maybe 2 months ago, and it is fan-fucking-tastic. It's the kind of thing that makes me mad. Like, more people should be able to see this, but because of how Orson Welles had to cobble together funding, and there's all kinds of rights stuff, and it's just sort of a mess. But it is great. It is just, you know, he plays Falstaff from the Shakespearean plays and sort of puts together all the stuff from like Henry IV's 1 and 2 and a little bit from Henry V and, you know, just Merry Wives of Windsor and all the different stuff to just sort of give you one character's story from start to finish instead of having him be a bit character in all these other plays. It is really good. Orson Welles is really good in it. It's visually stunning. I cannot recommend Chimes at Midnight / Falstaff enough. Especially if you're a Shakespeare fan, I think you'll really like it. It's sort of a different take. And that's it for this week. Stay classic.
Oh,
what the hell?
Bringing us into 2006 is Rihanna's SOS is number one this week, which sampled Tainted Love.
Yep.
It was a big hit. I remember this when this blew up in summer of 06, but the Chipettes covered it in Chipwrecked.
Whoa!
Years later, which I have seen. against my will.
Still one off on that tetralogy? You want to go see Road Chip?
I never did see Road Chip. I'm safe.
That is so weird that they, like, they still want the Chipettes to be as sexy as they were in the 80s, but they also have to look like chipmunks.
They are literal tiny chipmunks.
Yeah, it was a strange line.
I think that was the big secret. The Chipettes just look like people in the film. Like, they just look like little girls.
Yeah.
They have sort of regular hair and dresses and same,
So which one's the one for you?
Brittany, dude. Yeah, Jesus Christ. Why do you even have to ask?
Which one's the one with glasses?
Eleanor.
Eleanor. She's my favorite.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could go for that. anyway, Neil Young also had a new album, The Chili Peppers and Girl Talk, but the problem is, again, with 2006, the whole premise of the show being the 80s, not a lot was happening because the world was a lot slower back then. Mm-hmm. The 90s, that's where most of our memories for pop culture come from, and it informed so much of the rest of pop culture since the 90s. Mm-hmm. And in the 2006, the internet is in full blast, there's broadband everywhere, and there's too much shit in everything. So the number of albums out every week is devastating. Yes. Like, there's no point even reading them all because none of them stand out because, like, everything was... It's so saturated. Yeah. Like, and
things were few things were big hits. The Rihanna SOS actually was.
Yeah, Rihanna was huge and would remain huge for the next, well, even to this day, really. But if there's an album that came out this month for you in 2006 that sticks out to you, please, in the comments on lasertimepodcast.com, like, let us know, because this is an area also, I didn't have a radio in my car at this point, so I wasn't listening to the radio.
And on that note, like, movies that failed to meet a giant audience, I wasn't devouring on HBO every day after school either. So, like, it's hard to even talk about some of these films, especially this week's films.
Yeah. But news really quick, someone jotted in here, the 20th 9/11 hijacker, Zacharias
Moussaoui.
Pierce Brosnan out of that plane? What happened?
Sentenced to 6 life sentences, which I assume he's still serving.
Yes, he's in the Supermax in Colorado.
Wow.
He's the guy that is unclear whether or not he was actually supposed to be the 20th hijacker, but he was a Middle Eastern guy who was bouncing around, taking flight classes on 747s and being sketchy, and he knew some sketchy guys, and he got busted for his visa thing. But actually some guys from the flight school called the FBI and said, this guy's sketchy. Then he got busted for the visa thing before 9/11, and they just thought, he's some weirdo, and they didn't look into him that much, and they might have been able to... They might not have been able to stop 9/11, but they might have found a couple more of the guys. It's like I said, it's really still unclear. Like, did he know many of these guys? I don't know. Whatever.
I believe that was in my neck of the woods, the flight school.
Yeah, actually, he had the best argument. He was like, no, I was not going to be part of 9/11. I was working on my own terrorist thing.
The Donald Trump style. That was way better. It's going to be like 9/11.
No, he should have been like, it's going to be way shittier. Like, far fewer people killed. Much less devastating.
I should only have 2 life sentences. Yeah.
But movies, like you mentioned this week, get the fuck ready, because Goal, the first FIFA movie.
It's only interesting if you were following all that, I give John Oliver credit for kind of taking down FIFA as a journalistic endeavor.
At least telling America. Because
the rest of the world was aware of the corruption and all that stuff.
No.
But the clips of the movie, you see a FIFA celebrating itself. I assume this is another one.
This was the first one that was more of just like, it wasn't the creation of FIFA like the other one was, but with Sepp whatever in it.
Sepp Blatter, which was famously said, is what happens when somebody shits in your dick.
I do appreciate that John Oliver is just like, he has a more an international bent than he can just say, like, hey, America, all this shit has been happening for 40 years. You should know about this.
Mm-hmm. Also out, Just My Luck with Lindsay Lohan and Chris Pine.
I've never heard of this. Never heard of this.
Yeah. Moving on, the Poseidon Adventure remake by Wolfgang Peterson.
Yeah, I was looking.
I saw this on a bad movie night at my friend's house.
So who's the...
There's no reason. There's just no reason
to
bother.
Who's the famous person that surprisingly dies early? It's Kurt Russell, isn't it?
I don't remember if he dies. I think he might make it. I think Richard Dreyfuss might die.
It looks like he did from the trailer, and Andre Brouwer is in it a lot, but listed very low in the cast.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing he dies early.
Yeah, it's interesting talking about Twister from 10 years before this, and it's like, we get these little waves of disaster movies every now and then. I feel like this was, way too little too late on that trend.
Yes. Yeah, but it's a remake of the original disaster breakthrough, the Poseidon Adventure from the 60s.
Shelley Winters 70s. Swimming around.
And Ernest Borgnine.
Huge ensemble cast. Basically a ship that turns upside down. So it makes, even in this movie, it's a bunch of beautiful sets that just are upside down as a ship capsizes in the middle of the ocean.
It's the Dracula castle later in the game.
And I think Wolfgang Peterson is slightly underrated as a blockbuster director.
As that kind of director.
He made Das Boot. You'd think he would be all over this shit. It's pretty boring.
I just got more curious about the original, how like that was such a successful film based on a book that convinced the author to write a sequel to a disaster movie where people revisit the disaster scene and get caught again.
So it's The Lost World.
Bad. Yeah, yes. It's exactly, and then I was reading, but it was the original idea was that all the survivors from the original Poseidon Adventure are trucked off on a press tour and then get in a giant similar train accident.
And
that's too stupid. Not stupid enough to be resurrected 20 years later by Sylvester Stallone in the movie like Daylight or something like that.
Second Under Siege is on a train, isn't it?
But the
concept lived on into a Stallone movie in the 90s or early 2000s. But the coolest thing I could see about this, the Poseidon Adventure remake, Poseidon, according to the Guinness Book of World Records, circa 2008, so this might have changed, Poseidon holds the world record for the most detailed CGI shot. Over 182,000 individual, editable, and renderable objects, including 876 portholes, 382 cabins, down to 681 deck chairs and 72 towels.
Jesus.
I have to imagine Avatar beat that.
It might have, but if you later, think, if you like, think about what, the nature of what it is, like, you may not have... had need to show that much of a ship. Avatar's like usually two people and some trees. And
that's at least impressive in the way CG isn't anymore. I'm just like, when I see CG on anything, it just makes me like, yeah, he made CG. Who cares?
Yeah,
like,
I think it made I
underappreciate the work goes into that stuff by the CGI artist.
Yeah, you can think of CG as like animation, as someone creating some like drawing something that's on film. But the idea that the boat itself was a model that they could manipulate with it. To a billion degrees.
Skin it with some Mountain Dew things or Doritos. And
When you break it down to that, there's 180,000 individual objects. Like, that is not unimpressive on a technical scale.
Yeah, the computing power on that, I'm sure, is pretty impressive. Mm-hmm. I know one thing, as you mentioned, John Oliver, another former Daily Show correspondent, we just missed, and I feel so stupid that we missed this. April 29th, we missed Stephen Colbert hosting the White House correspondence.
Oh my gosh.
Which is still... I
can't believe we missed that.
That changed the White House correspondence.
I tweeted it recently. That was when, like, people were legitimately up in arms for questioning the president at this time. And Colbert mocked George Bush mercilessly to his face.
I remember seeing clips of it then and thinking, like, this is a joke. Like, there's no way he's actually there saying these things. And then as you're watching the clip, you're like... Because, at that time, like, to confront the president was like, boo, hiss!
Yeah, and give him shit about, so your 30% approval rating and your vast failures in Iraq.
I just remember he compared George W. Bush while sitting next to him as the captain of the Titanic hitting an iceberg. And then threw in the line, and tell all your children to say goodbye to an iceberg because it's not likely they'll see them again.
My favorite line was when he first got up there. He's like, I'm so excited to be here. It feels like a dream. Someone should pitch me. You know what? No, don't do that. Somebody should shoot me in the face. Is that guy here? Oh, he's not here. Oh.
Yeah, that is the point where he points out, now late Justice Antonin Scalia, a justice on the Supreme Court of the United States of these Americas, and gives him a bunch of rude Italian hand gestures. Yeah. Like, there's Scalia. Yeah. Hey, buys out. Hey, how about one of these?
It's baffling.
You know what this means.
It's baffling to see just because, like, did they think his character was real? That's the only thing you can imagine. Character of the Colbert Report, Colbert was real.
Nice pundit for us to come and be funny.
I think somebody thought that.
No, so what happened?
They don't have a sense of humor about themselves.
They talk about it in the books. I read about this, that the head of the White House correspondence group that put it together, its union or whatever, he nominated Stephen Colbert, and the Bush administration had never heard of him, apparently. And so he just kind of snuck him on, and he knew he was sneaking him on. And when Colbert got the offer, him and Stewart both were like, holy shit. and they said they worked harder on that than they had in anything in a long time. They were so excited to do it. And also the other story I heard is when Colbert came off stage, he said a distinguished black actor who he would not name, who I think is Morgan Freeman, said after he left the stage to silence and discomfort, the distinguished actor says to him, hey, that was great. And then he says, really? I don't think any of those people liked it. And the actor said to him, fuck them.
That's one of those things I'll call some of the best pound-for-pound minutes on YouTube. Colbert at the White House Press Correspondents Center, only beaten the other day by Obama himself delivering his fuck you mic. Literally drops a mic.
Obama's thing was the greatest ever. It was so great. I did love a few years ago when... Seth Meyers hosted it, and Trump was there in the audience when he was first toying around with the idea of running for president. He said, I hear you're running for president I hear Donald Trump is running as president, which is funny because I thought he was running as a joke.
Oh boy, but here we are.
Alright, television.
TV this week.
Okay.
TV's garbage, but so the final episode of Sonic X aired on May 6th in the U.S.
What the fuck is that?
It's a kid in Norway, I think.
Dude, that is not Chili Dogs.
Let's hear the theme song.
Oh man, so I never did watch this show for obvious reasons. Gotta go fast. Easy. Moving at speed of sound. We try. We can't.
she's hedgehog around. Found ourselves in situation.
All right, so he's, oh! I got it. He's fast.
Yeah, all right, so.
Sugar, frosted, frozen bombs, you want to eat them right now.
So what was kind of special, what was kind of special about Sonic X was that of all the Sonic animated series, it was one of the first that was an anime first in Japan, made for the Japanese audience, that then got localized to America, which means Sega was more involved and it had pretty much the Sonic Adventure cast of the mid-2000s, which means Cream the Rabbit, Shadow the Hedgehog.
No. Rouge the Bat.
Rouge the Bat. And they then put in a human character who, like, the child kids can project themselves onto, Chris.
Because I couldn't do that to Sonic. Certainly and not. I wouldn't want to be Sonic. Yeah. Instead, I'm going to think, I want to be that normal child.
Yeah, and compared to the Hedgehog, the kid's like 50 feet tall, right?
No, they're the same size.
That makes sense.
So, but he gets teleported to the world in the first episode, and it also has stuff with, like, the Chaotix Detective Agency is in it.
Vector the Crocodile? and you can quiz me, man.
Jizz the Bee?
Charmy the Bee.
My bad.
The final episode is kind of an epilogue to the big Super Saiyan fight that ended the series of Super Sonic versus Super Shadow, and Chris is now getting to teleport back to his world, and Eggman is like, but the battle will never end. I don't care if Chris is gone. This fight will go forever. Yeah, it was pretty lame, and the only other thing I know about it is that Sonic stalwarts really hate the localization that 4Kids Entertainment gave to it. They're like, they cut out all this stuff and wrote Sonic stupider. Like, yeah, I'm sure the anime is much better. Like, the Japanese version must be so much better. Though the animation isn't bad because it was produced by TMS, the studio behind all the best animated episodes of Tiny Toons and Batman and pretty much every DC Animated Universe show.
I would like to just take a moment to come clean and that there is a lot of work being done outside of the studio that's probably picking up on Mike right
there's
about
just
now.
A bee with a giant drill and a bus and a sander that's just leaning on it, and he's flapping his wings as hard as he can.
Yeah, it's really weird. He's got a stinger on his nose. He's a real big cartoon.
The only other
which is strange. Like, bees don't have stingers on them. What's going on?
The only other big TV news I found was Fatal Contact, Bird Flu in America, the TV movie starring Stacy Keach. Going into a couple episodes back, we talked about how scary bird flu was in America at that time, and this fed into the panic.
It's going to happen. There's going to be a disease, a plague of some kind, and I'm not going to believe it because a 24-hour news cycle has cried wolf so many times to all of these diseases that I just don't care anymore. I will not pay attention.
But the big news, I'd say, for 2006 was we missed this on May 3rd, but it was in full swing by May 6th, the free comic book day. 10 years ago, to the day almost, of the release of the Captain America Civil War film, is issue number one of Civil War, the Marvel Comics crossover mega event that, for real, did change everything. They always say, this crossover is going to change everything. It never does. This one did.
This did fuck everything up for like 5 years.
I started to read comics like frequently again just like 5, 6, 7 years ago, and like it's referenced constantly.
Yeah, it was a big deal. And it is nuts that it's almost 10 years to the day that the movie came out.
Yeah, so the short version of the comic book Civil War is it was made in the shadow of 9/11 and the expansion of domestic terrorism and government regulation, the Patriot Act, all that stuff.
I think you can impress a ton of things on it. It's also a nice little parable for gun control.
Yeah.
But I don't like that because I'm on this. That would put me on the side of no gun control, and I don't want that.
That's what makes it complicated. That's what makes. I think in hindsight, you didn't like the story.
I liked it at the time, but it is a lot of people have to act kind of out of character for things to happen.
So that's my view on it too. Is that so? The series was conceived by and written and drawn by Mark Miller, was the writer, who was a mega superstar. He created the Ultimates. Yeah. Like, there was no hotter writer in comics at that time, I would say. And the artist was Steve McNiven, who was really, really great.
It's really great art.
Though that great art comes at a price, which is time. Yeah. And there were multiple delays on the book, which made line-wide delays, because it was actually such an integrated story into it that almost every comic was like, this comic is tied directly to Civil War 4. Yeah. This cannot be published before Civil War 4 because it will spoil things. Like
Spider-Man outs himself as Secret Identity.
The biggest one was, was that 4 or 3? I forget.
I thought that was 2.
Oh, yeah, it was the end of two. The end of two, Peter Parker unmasks himself and reveals a secret identity.
The catalyst for the pro and anti-registration movement is even more... I get that they're using what they have in the MCU. It looks like the Winter Soldier is the catalyst for...
We haven't seen the movie yet.
At the time of this recording. But the catalyst in the comics was a young teen group of superheroes who were also on a reality show.
It was the New Warriors who were on a reality show, which was what was happening with the New Warriors at the time. As New Warriors fan, I hated that they were cast as these losers who explode a school and kill 600 people.
Yeah, like cause a devastating event.
They get in a fight
town.
With villains. They try to pick a fight for their show. The villains are like, "Who the fuck are you?" Mm-hmm. And one of the villains' Nitro? Powers is blowing up, and he blows up a school and kills a shit ton of kids. And everyone's like, "Okay, that's fucking it.
That's it." Superheroes are going to need to register their identities with the government, and it is. I love that the MCU doesn't have secret identities for the most part now.
So the movies,
and so turn into a big split of. Iron Man leading one side saying his best argument was this is going to happen anyway. The government is definitely going to regulate us, and you'd rather have me, Iron Man, in charge of that than somebody you don't know. You can trust me. I'll be the great to be in charge of
this.
When have
I ever lied to you?
Meanwhile, Captain America says this is un-American, unconstitutional.
The last time we put people on lists.
Yeah, and I'm going to stop this. And so he creates a group of freedom fighters, and it became just choose a side. And every Marvel character picked a side.
Yeah, that's interesting because, I've only seen the movies, but I enjoyed them. Mm-hmm. That when you say, oh, it's going to be about registration and trusting the government versus not, my initial thought is it's going to be the opposite sides. That Captain America is a square who's going to do what people tell him to do because he's a soldier. And Tony Stark is the ultimate capitalist who we've seen in movies before say, this is my private property and you can't have it.
We just talked about Winter Soldier on Cape Crisis, but it was the beginning of Ed Brubaker making Captain America not a wiener.
Yeah,
good
like,
for him.
Like representative of like old school values that are not interpreted the same way.
Yeah,
and
really.
Miller started it too. In Ultimate Cap, which he created, was very much not a wiener.
Yeah, it was definitely more of a. It's not the government, and that I obey the flag at all costs. It's that I obey this core idea of
justice, and liberty.
Justice, and equality, and you can't. The government can't tell people what to do because that's one step removed from kings and queens and tyranny and you can't tell. You can't force me.
Yeah, I punched a guy who was into that sort of thing.
none of you were around when I did that. So.
And it's a fun book, though. It also, you look back on it now, and everything's been changed from it. It didn't last. But if you expect anything in comics, a status quo in comics to last more than 5 years, you're a crazy person.
I'd say it's one of the longest status quos.
And it led to a lot of crazy shit. It is weird that World War
Two
Hulk
Avengers
was
teams.
After that, but things like Dark Reign, Secret Invasion, these are all things that... World War Hulk's the weird outlier.
Age. Siege. It was a lot of fun stuff came from it. A lot of great. It was a new era in Marvel Comics, and I did have a clip of this is current day Mark Miller reflecting on the work. He's Scottish, so forgive his accent.
I mean, the important thing there really is the Superhero Registration Act. It's nothing to do with secret identities. Weirdly, people get really hung up in the whole secret identity thing. But when I was writing that book, I was thinking about having the superheroes having to expose their identities as they all, get brought under government legislation. And then I said to Marvel, who's got a secret identity? And they said, no one. There's basically Spider-Man. Everybody, even Daredevil, had given up his secret identity at this point. And I was like, all right. So I made it about something else. And what it's about is... The Iron Man feels that anybody who's walking around with a nuclear reactor on their back or whatever, all these superheroes that's out there, should be under government control of some kind. They should be maybe working for the government in the same way cops work for local government, And it's sensible when you think about it. It totally makes sense. You have a license. You make sure this guy's okay. He doesn't have a criminal record and all this kind of stuff, And it's sensible, but Captain America's against it because, he comes from a simpler time and he feels superheroes should be autonomous and not be involved in politics and everything. So it's an ideological argument between the two. And that's all that matters. That's all Civil War is. It's Iron Man versus Captain America, and they're both right.
I like that. And that was something a lot of tie-ins forgot, that they tried to make one side wrong.
Yeah.
But Mark Miller did do a very good tightrope act of no, neither side's wrong here. You might, depending on your...
Tony Stark has a disproportionate response to all of this stuff.
But he's
but
doing it for
philosophy
the right
is relatable.
He does build a cyborg clone of Thor.
Who kills Goliath, one of the few major black superheroes at the time. Yeah. Yeah, and it ends. One last thing I want
because
to mention
Thor was dead at this point. Like he died in like 04 or something, and he was dead up until maybe 07.
Dead in the Civil War movie too.
Yeah, he wasn't brought back at any point that time. So he's like, but I want Thor. I want Thor in this thing. And also, like the X-Men are not in it either. Yeah.
Just like in real life.
Yes,
it's very strange that if looking at the MCU, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, they have been on an accelerated course towards this.
Yeah.
Since the first Avengers film.
Yeah.
That's what that's about. That's true. Fury, like, Thor's the reason we changed everything and how we pleased the universe. Winter Soldier's about that going too far.
In the first Avengers film, when they argue, when Steve and Tony start arguing, I was like, this is the past of the Civil War right here. Like, I'm seeing it begin.
Yeah.
And that was very exciting. And yeah, so the book ends at the end of 06 with Cap almost killing Iron Man, but then realizing that he lost the people, like that the people aren't on his side anymore, and then he gives up. And that ending was actually pitched by Joss Whedon. They were at a retreat, and Joss Whedon,
the only comic book writer,
we can't think of the ending to this. Like, why would Cap give up? And so Joss Whedon was the one who pitched that.
This motherfucking bee. I can't believe this.
Luckily, he's a big fan of remote control planes.
Luckily, that's the end of this stupid show.
Thank God.
Thanks for listening. You can find out more at lasertimepodcast.com. We also do other shows such as Laser Time.
Yeah, baby. I believe I've been on a streak of things that I didn't think would work but are fun for Laser Time.
Uh-huh.
What?
Just I feel like he's leaning even harder on the drill.
We're going to do a recap of Civil War, so that's what's on Laser Time this week. But before that, if you don't want spoilers, Dead Media Formats, an exploration of physical media that is dearly departed, kind of like partially on the HD DVD conversation we had on this show.
Yeah, yeah.
And then what's the oldest toy in the toy aisle? Who is the oldest character in the toy aisle? And again, apologies to Mr. Potato Head. He wasn't there, man. He wasn't there.
Oh, and there's also a great podcast about The Simpsons, Talking Simpsons. Every week we discuss one episode of the series, episode by episode from the beginning, and we are into the third season a bit deep now. And also, if you like that comic book talk on here, I do a whole podcast about that called Cape Crisis. And I have to remind you guys, this is Patreon supported, patreon.com/lasertime. We do, among other things, the weekly Bonus Time podcast, which is a lot of fun, and you are missing out if you are not listening. So please give us some help, guys.
Yeah, it's a bit freewheeling, but we've been doing our best to make it like as valuable as our other shows with research and a little prep.
That's cool. And if you like the Vidya Game Talk, then there's Vidya Game Apocalypse, which is hosted by my husband, Mr. Michael Raparez. And also, I should add, if you subscribe to us on iTunes, if you could rate and review us, because we are such a newish show, that would be very helpful. I've read through a bunch of our reviews. They're so nice. So thank you so much if you reviewed the show already.
And on that note, I think we launched a bunch of our shows onto other places you might listen to podcasts. Google Play and Stitcher?
Yeah, Google Play just added podcast functionality, though not on the iOS version of the app. But say if you've got a Droid and that's how you'd prefer to listen to podcasts, we're now on there. All of the Laser Time podcasts are on there, including this one you're listening to.
And no pressure, but like rating, reviewing, all that stuff in these early periods of being on those platforms would really help us out.
Really help.
And if you have the option just to one-click rate us, that'd be really awesome.
Check out our YouTube page. We do a lot of looks back at like not just games, but also we've been looking at the Marvel 1990 trading card set. We've been playing a lot of real superhero games.
I got a really quickie video on about 8 stupid things Superman does in video games.
Yeah.
And we did on Patreon, we did a live commentary of Short Circuit.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And also, it is time now for our final segment.
Oh, birthday!
The whole movie's birthday song. So, birthdays in this time period of the show, which is May 6th through the 12th. Good God. George Clooney. Kevin Steen, a.k.a. Kevin Owens, Enrique Iglesias, Billy Joel, Bono,
that's
Tony Hawk, and a quiz, born May 10th, 1978.
Right.
First movie, I believe, was D2 Mighty Ducks.
What?
He was in 2004's Fat Albert.
Kenan Thompson.
He is Kenan Thompson. SNL cast member Kenan Thompson.
What's Kenan?
Birthday this very weak.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday, the person we always hear about saying laser time.
Yeah. Wow, yeah.
Keenan Thompson.
And also that I love pointing out about Keenan Thompson has been doing sketch comedy the majority of his life, counting all that. And I think he's approaching, if not, if he hasn't surpassed, the longest running SNL cast member.
Wow.
He's a great utility player.
Dude, it's like over two decades of his life in sketch comedy.
We'll head out with, because of all that weather talk in the middle, I'm going to go out with one of these Weather Channel songs from that exact same year, 1996. Again, this is a point where, like, again, if you're Midwest or Northeast, like, you were watching the Weather Channel a lot because summer it's storms and winter it's shitty weather. So you end up watching it, and then a bunch of people get pulled into this, like, this music is really good. And as time goes on, we would find out that this guy's name was Trammell Starks, and he made CDs and has all this music, and I've actually now been in touch with him, and, like, through a listener was able to connect me to him and then sent me CDs of that music that I have VHSs of that I would just sit as a teenager and watch and listen to the music. And now I have the CDs, and it's nuts. But I'll go out with one of the songs from those Weather Channel songs, because it's insane how fun it's goofy music, but man, it's good stuff. But we'll be back next week with another look back at 30 years ago, 20 years ago, and 10 years ago.